You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Erica Katz, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here in person. You are the co-founder and co-CEO of Seed. So Seed, from my understanding, comes somewhat from an insight that the scientific community has had over the past 15, 20 years that the human body is at least half bacteria and half human cells. And that leads to all kinds of interesting things. I think people who've been reading the news might have seen that the microbes in your gut influence your mood, and that all kinds of other things relating to these bacteria that are living all over us and inside of us affect us. And so you're creating a variety of products that try to help with building a healthy microbiome. Is that a fair way of describing it?
Yes, let me unpack that a little bit. So Seed comes from the biological term seeding, and that process is basically an infant and your experience, your first exposure to microbes, which is the seeding of your microbiome, which is, if you think about planting a garden,
right.
Which is kind of a little bit of what happens during the development of an embryo and then a fetus and eventually an infant, used to be thought that, and it's probably why you've heard a lot about like maybe the controversy between vaginal birth and C-section, for example. Mm-hmm. At birth, you certainly do get what they call kind of like the mother load of microbes, whether it's through the vaginal canal or C-section. It's kind of like your moment that you're exposed to the most you've been exposed to as a life. Mm-hmm. But what we now know is that that process of seeding actually happens prior to birth. They used to think that the fetus was sterile, and they now have in the last few years started to discover that microbes are actually present prior to birth. But seeding itself just describes that process of an infant's first exposure to microbes. And that is the seeds, quote unquote, that kind of begin the development and the growth of your microbiome, which is the collection of all microbes that live on and within your body. And so, for example, right at birth, a vaginal born baby, their microbiome resembles more the microbes that come from the mom's vagina, some fecal matter, a little bit of the skin, and then eventually, of course, what's on the nipples, and then some environmental exposures, of course, once they're born. But for a C-section baby, just at first, and I don't want to sensationalize that difference because science is starting to prove otherwise, their microbiome, of course, resembles more not the vaginal microbiome, but the skin.
But a baby doesn't yet have like 50% microbes in their body. How long does it take to like get to that point?
So what you're referring to is what they call kind of a steady state microbiome. There's kind of a window. I don't think there's like an actual date, but somewhere between 2 and 4 years of age is when, and some of that is impacted on whether or not an infant is breastfed, many other environmental factors, and whether or not an infant has antibiotics within, let's say, the first couple of years of life. So, but for a normal kind of a breastfed, healthy child, regardless of vaginal birth or C-section, particularly if they were breastfed and didn't have antibiotics, by about 2.5, somewhere between 2 and 4 years, they reach what they call a steady state microbiome, which is kind of basically your microbiome for life. And that, and that sets the stage for, and certainly determines, and they're starting to understand that more, the direction for much of how you will, your at least your digestive system, your immune system, for example, will develop.
Give people like an idea of, you know, in that steady state, how many different organisms, different species, different things that
there's hundreds of species. To your question about how long have we known about the microbiome, and you said 15, 20 years, it's actually, you know, we've of course known about bacteria for a very long time, microbiology, of course, but it wasn't actually until the Human Genome Project that we had what was called 16S sequencing technology that allowed us to understand and characterize the genes of the microbes
inside
of us.
And what year was that?
So that was about 15 years, but really microbiome science, it's really been more in the last decade
there's really been an acceleration just of like research going on in this area, and the discoveries are like pretty profound because we think of ourselves as like what we can see on the outside, the organs, our bodies, but there's so much happening at, you know, the cellular microscopic level that is influencing the overall body. And everything, there's so many different microbiomes. We focus a lot on the gut. You mentioned the vaginal microbiome. There's a lot going on in the feces, like transplant area. There's stuff that's happening in your mouth. There's stuff that's happening on your skin, like all these different areas. And I think it's just something that we're getting used to.
So yes, you are absolutely correct that microbes play a role in our biology in ways that we have now characterized and know. Of course, you know, GI health and digestive health, and of course, immune health is probably what's most top of mind because there's been so much marketing put on top of it, because the microbiome is such an interesting space and it's such a strange confluence of factors that have driven this, which is that you've never had a field of science on the velocity and acceleration that microbiome science is on that is equally paired with the growth in a consumer category like probiotics. Mm. So you have the microbes inside of you that we're starting to understand and characterize and understand mechanism. And of course, you have these different ecosystems of your bodies. You're kind of, your skin's like a coral reef. The vaginal microbiome's like a rainforest. Your gut's like a, each one is its own ecosystem with its own species. Your and my skin microbiome is more alike than your skin and your gut.
Yeah.
So they truly are totally different ecosystems, which means they have different mechanisms. They impact and interplay with one another in very different ways. I mean, if you think about it, we sequence the human genome. You can't go to Whole Foods and buy anything for your genome.
Mm-hmm.
But we sequence the microbiome, and all of a sudden, we start to understand not just how our own microbes behave, but how the administration of microbes to our bodies will behave. So probiotics are bacteria that administer some sort of health benefit to the host. And those are bacteria. That is a field that has also kind of paralleled the rise of microbiome science. And that's because microbiome science is such an interesting field in that so much of what we start to understand about our microbes in some cases is immediately actionable. Hmm. Whereas in other areas of science, you know, like sequencing the human genome, there are actions, but it's not as it doesn't drive a consumer category like probiotics, which is the fastest growing consumer health category in the world.
That's pretty crazy. So what is Seed trying to do? You have your own research and R&D going on, which is kind of fascinating. I want to hear more about that. And you've got your products, and the first set of products launched about a year ago or so.
So we launched launched a daily symbiotic, which is a combination of probiotics and prebiotics last June. And we have a male and female formulation. Yeah, so almost coming, well, a little less than a year, although we sold out very fast. So we have a lot of customers who are probably like, and when is the shipping? So I apologize. Two reasons that we founded Seed. One is that we believe the potential, kind of what you spoke so articulately to at the opening, which is the potential of the microbiome and understanding microbes and their impact on human and planetary health is extraordinary.
Right.
We are like in the Friendster period of microbiome at the moment and of probiotics. But what happened is that because the term probiotics is not regulated, everything's a probiotic now. You just throw bacteria in something and it's probiotic. There is, however, a very real scientific definition that was authored by the WHO and the UN in 2001 by our chief scientist. And that has not been upheld. And that is where you need human clinical work. That is where you need to actually understand the benefit and then conserve what was studied in the product to be able to claim those benefits. Hmm. That is currently not regulated. And so what we saw was looking at the potential of probiotics and how they are going to grow as a field and touch all kinds of categories and ecosystems of our body, as you pointed out, whether it's our skin, for women, of course, vaginal health. When you think about nurturing those early windows of a microbiome's development for an infant, those are all areas that we look at. But what no one was doing was saying, well, who's going to be the scientific standard of probiotics if nobody's regulating this? If you can have probiotic tortilla chips and probiotic shampoo, and every fermented food is called a probiotic, and every kombucha is called a probiotic, and every supplement that decides to throw bacteria in, sometimes with no specificity of like which strains are in it, just says the species, you know, how is that all a probiotic? And who's going to steward the future of this?
Can you repeat the definition?
Sure. It's live microorganisms, when administered in an adequate amount, confer a benefit to the human host.
And so when you think about stuff that people can find off the shelf, what are tips that you would give someone who's like looking at something on a shelf that's like telling them it's a probiotic, how to deal with that?
I mean, the first question to ask is, what are the human clinical studies behind the strains?
So it's about the strains within that particular product.
Saying I take probiotics is like saying I like books.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which books? That's how, right. Which books? Do they say anything? Do they just have a, you know, if you just say the species, it's like having a cover with no words inside.
Interesting. So, and do you find that there are companies out there that do a decent job with that?
You know, we don't spend a lot of time policing or trying to, you know, poke holes in other companies. I would say we started this because we couldn't find the companies that we felt. I think in Europe there absolutely are some. I think one of the other loopholes that happens is that, you know, not only people not disclose the strains or the clinical studies, but what they do is that if there is a clinical study, very rarely are they taking the dosage that was studied in the human clinical study and making sure it's preserved in the dosage that's in the product. And so that's a really important distinction. So even if there is a study, then the question is, well, did you preserve the conditions under which the bacteria were biofermented? Did you, the mediums, for example, the pH, the way that, I mean, fermentation, as you know from like people who love wine, is an art form. There's a lot of things that impact the growth of how bacteria grow. And so then the question is, were the conditions preserved from the clinical trial and the dosage to the product?
What are some of the other myths out there about probiotics or these types of products?
A lot of the myth is just the use of the term. So the idea that you can just throw probiotics into a product and then call it a probiotic, XYZ probiotic chocolate, for example, is a myth. So CFU, you know, that big number that's like the billions, the kajillions, right. You know, we're very proud that we're pursuing, you know, much, much more specific testing methodologies, which demonstrate the real active and viable bacteria versus CFU, which is kind of a very crude, older methodology. A lot of people play the numbers game there, and it's really misrepresentative of what's actually viable in the product by the time it gets to your, not just to your body, but to your colon. The myth that probiotics need to be refrigerated to be viable, I think that confers the responsibility to the consumer instead of the responsibility to the company to figure out how to stabilize microbes. We also don't know the impact of condensation on bacteria.
That's an interesting one that people might ask questions, because your product comes like in a jar, in a pill form, and it's room temperature. How do you stabilize it?
Well, we're currently stabilized up to 79 degrees Fahrenheit, but we actually have a new technology that we're launching soon that is going to confer even longer shelf stability and a higher heat stability as well.
Is it the capsule outside, or what is it that does that?
Yeah, there's a couple things. Primarily, it is the lyophilization process. So lyophilization is just a fancy word for kind of freeze drying. And so there's a couple pieces to it. One is a micro encapsulation that we use for some of our more sensitive strains. That's actually an algae polymer that actually, like, on a micro level, like, encapsulates some of our more sensitive strains. And algae is very pH sensitive. So it constricts in the higher pH, which is kind of higher in the GI tract. And then as it gets to the colon, which is a lower pH, they open. But that's not for all of our strains. Certainly our capsules are resistant, but really it comes down to how they're lyophilized, which is an important part of the process.
I never heard that term before.
Yeah, well, you learn a new term.
So, and it's not refrigerated. So people, as long as they're keeping it sort of in a cooler place, they don't need to keep your product in the fridge?
No.
That's interesting.
No. I mean, one of the things that we love to understand at Seed is kind of the way that marketing teaches us about health and products, which is really fascinating. So if you go back to the understanding of, like, the way we've been messaged about fat or cholesterol, really anything that's enjoyed its moment of demonization in popular right. like nutrition science. It's very fascinating to us, you know, whether it's the yogurt industry or, you know, the supplement industry, and just the ways in which, and they're not, I mean, they come from, of course, like, we don't think everybody has poor intentions, but it is fascinating to us the way that marketing shapes the way we decide what something is good or bad. And then ultimately, like, it's very hard to undo some of those. And so we spend a lot of time on our Instagram and in our community and in our messaging myth busting.
Yeah.
Not just about bacteria, but if you think about it, I mean, the history of bacteria bacteria has had a really bad rap.
Sure.
You know, over 99% of bacteria is honestly kind of what they kind of call commensal, or, you know, are good for the most part, good or just kind of ineffective,
right.
and non-pathogenic. But of course, you know, we first decided that bacteria was bad, and it's kind of been, you know, the theater kid of microbiology for a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure people have read the stories about like antibacterial soaps and all that kind of stuff that is just basically like destroying your microbiome.
Yeah, I mean, we, you know, we decided that, you know, and I think just we have a history of humans as purists, and I think we've unfortunately done this to people and various communities of humanity, as well as in this case bugs and bacteria. And so, you know, they really were associated with this notion of being dirty. I mean, look, you can thank Victorian aristocracy for like the toilet, which fundamentally is not actually good for our GI tract. Totally changes the angle for like elimination and not actually what's healthy. And then, of course, you end up with 68 million Americans constipated, not just for that reason, but for many other reasons. But it's, you know, it's very odd how these ideas that we had, you know, Listerine. And if you look at the history of kind of bacteria and how things like Listerine, Anton Lister, you know, came up with, you know, of course, ways that we could kill them in our mouth. And, you know, you look at, as you mentioned, all the soaps and this kind of obsession with cleanliness. And so we've cleaned ourselves sick. Mm-hmm. We always talk about what's happening right now with our health as kind of the climate change of our insides. You know, you learn in like, you know, fourth, fifth grade about like the rainforest and, you know, how the diversity of the rainforest is decreasing. Well, if you think about your gut or your microbiome as a rainforest, it is the same thing. Diversity is one of the main markers of health of a microbiome. And as that diversity has decreased in the various ecosystems of our body, specifically our gut being probably the most notable one, we've seen this huge rise in autoimmune. I mean, we've never had the rate of non-communicable disease as a human species ever in history that we do today. We are dying from things that are not contagious.
Yeah.
It's never happened.
Wow. When you launched and your website first came out, it was very different than any other website that I had ever been to. And I thought that was a rare thing. Like these days, it's not. I basically work, my main stuff is being a web designer, basically, if you want to simplify it. So it was fascinating.
I saw some of the books around here. I wouldn't necessarily, I think that might be overly reductive.
Okay, well, but my day-to-day job is like user interface for this like platform that we're building. But so it's very fascinating. But it's not just about the way it looks. It's the information that you're sharing. You've gone out of your way to spend a lot of time on education. The photography on your website is beautiful. Some of it is like microscopic photography of actual bacteria. And there's a component there of how do you make this interesting for people? How do you get them excited and curious and want to read up about the science of this? How did you go about like deciding what the identity and the approach to telling the world about seed should be?
Well, thank you. The team will be happy to hear that. And the truth is, we spend way more time. I think we always joke that our Google Docs are at like, you know, always get to like version 30 before we do anything. And I think, well, a couple things. One is that we think science has a real communication problem. One of the reasons that so many of these wellness companies and the vernacular of wellness has been able to persist is because science just simply doesn't know how to reach the mass consumer. So the reason that we can so freely talk about cleansing and detoxing and actually, you know, detoxification, which is a biological term, you know, the reason that those things have been able to be so easily co-opted by things that have no science is because science does not have a good methodology for reaching people. And that's both in its aesthetic and its language. And so I think one of the things that we really, there's kind of two driving ideas behind everything we do. The first is this notion that friction is the future. So I think we've realized that all the things that get in, you would appreciate this as a someone on the web, which is, and you can see this in very, very nuanced ways in like in culture and in apps and kind of what's happening in our lives, and even to a certain extent meditation, which is a form of friction, I think, is this notion that, you know, everybody went through a period of time. It's kind of like, I almost liken it to like the digital technologies industrial revolution, which was that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Metropolis, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, where, you know, we got everyone to realize that, you could download a lot, you could get a lot of users really quickly. You could get someone through a funnel really fast through checkout. you could figure out how to gamify something to be able to get everyone just like Wall-E style, staring at a screen, or like, of course, in certain social media UI or UXs, you could get them, get something gamified to the place where somebody actually starts opening it without even thinking about it. Right. There's such a feedback loop with like dopamine. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, you know, what ultimately the Industrial Revolution did was figure out how you could replicate something very quickly. And so 1.0 or of this last period of internet technology and all these brands that, and these particularly with e-commerce, the methodology has been, how do you get someone really quickly to do things, and how do you get many people to do that same thing over and over and over again?
Right.
And that dictates your value.
Yeah. So when you arrive to the Seed website, it's not add to cart. It's like you have to find that product page through layers of like education.
Yes. So now, of course, everyone's writing blogs about like, well, maybe it's more about LTV. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's more about the value. Maybe it's about smaller communities engaging more. Maybe it's, and I think that we're watching this kind of happen across, as I mentioned, many areas of our life and culture. But I think what we really believed was that, how could you make science so engaging and beautiful, and could that empowerment drive someone to feel like, okay, I actually trust this company. I may not even buy anything right now. I just learned something. Hmm. And that, could you be that point of just like that aha moment for somebody, which, you know, if you ask a lot of scientists why they became a scientist, they'll tell you that many of them had this kind of aha moment about the world, about their bodies, about their health. And so to go to my other, as I said, there's kind of two things. We talk about friction as the future. And then the other one is we talk about what could mean to empower what we call the interview effect, which is, have you heard of the overview effect?
No. So, I mean, it sounds familiar.
Yeah,
but
so
really
the
know.
Overview effect was coined in the late 70s by an astronaut. And the astronauts talk about the overview effect.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because it's the first moment that an astronaut looks back
at the Earth,
from space and sees it in its entirety. And there's this aha moment of a kind of stewardship, of a kind of, that's my home. Like, I must care for that. Like, that has to persist.
Yeah.
Everything I know, everyone I love, everyone they love.
You're speaking
exists.
My language. I mean, yeah, that's like the pale blue dot. It's it's a whole Earth catalog.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we always say, like, and one of our scientists, just George Church, who you may know, who is the scientist bringing back the woolly mammoth from extinction to try
right,
to
right.
reverse climate
Stuart
change.
Brandon. Yeah, yes, they're working on that. Yeah, it's amazing.
In fact, the two little dogs in our office, Sasha and Luca, come from the tundra trip that George Church and Stuart Brand went on with Raja recently.
Wow.
And he rescued them from the tundra. So if anyone ever wants to see cute puppies from the tundra, come
amazing.
To my office. And so that idea of, well, if we're so enamored with the cosmos, how could we not find a way to be so enamored with this cosmos,
ourselves.
Yeah. Mm. And I think we really try and at least invoke that wherever we can, because I think we treat our bodies very transactionally.
Yeah.
And we don't treat space that way, and we don't treat our awe of other things that way. And I think, you know, we talk about climate change, talk about saving the ocean, and we, you know, with this idea of like somehow we are not of it, we are like, we are here to save it, and we are other. And so I think we really try and draw that connection and decide that, like, if you could change the way science looks and feels and sounds, could you make somebody like so in awe of themselves that every time they're about to make a decision about what to eat, what to put in their bodies, what to put on their bodies, you know, what would it change? You know, could you see your body from that spaceship and see it the way you would see Earth, for example? And so those are the two kind of guiding principles for us.
That is very philosophically powerful, because I think that you were talking about this before with like the human instinct to cleanse things, where I think maybe over the past couple of decades, we've started to appreciate, especially through understanding mental health a little more, that we're really not in control of ourselves. We're not in control of, there's a lot of things that humans want to have control over, but we don't. And when I think about bacteria, I think it's like an uncontrollable force. It's like there, and if you accept the fact that they're living inside of you, all over you, that there's so many of them.
And even by the way, help you with a lot of things.
Yes, and are fighting for you and like protecting you from diseases and helping you digest foods and do all kinds of stuff. It's like it opens up this mindset where it's okay for things to be chaotic. Like, there is this idea, this is one of my personal philosophies, is that chaos is good. Like, the nature of humans and life forms is to enhance chaos, is to increase the amount of complexity and chaos, as opposed to the emptiness that is like space and rocks and the void.
Chaos to me, if you, when you understand like what complex or even some more simple organisms are doing, is not chaos to me.
Sure.
It is simply the wiring to sustain life.
Well, it's sort of what I mean by that is more like, this is a very old idea of nature abhors a vacuum. Like,
sure,
it is looking for places to find a new ecological niche and grow into it and try to understand it. And it's very complex and sprawling, maybe is more
absolutely,
than chaotic.
Well, certainly it is extraordinarily complex, but with a simple mission. I mean, there's no...
To reproduce?
To sustain
natural
life.
Selection.
I mean, that, you know, we talk about, yes, of course, bacteria help you digest food, but what they have found in you is a warm place to live and a constant nutrient supply.
Yeah.
So that in nature, I think we always need to put something in terms of it's working for us or against us. And that is the binary way in which humans must see the world. But actually, in biology, it's called mutualism, which is the notion that we could both exist and both get what we need, which, of course, a lot of relationships could
benefit. Well, I mean, it's like, you know, a cleaner fish or something living on another fish, like a symbiotic relationship. But this is on a different scale. If there's hundreds and hundreds of species like living on you and around you, this is going to take us off track maybe, but are you a believer in panspermia? The theory that, going back to the idea of seeding, that Earth was seeded from maybe a meteor that came and like brought bacteria from another place to this planet. Like, it's one of the ideas of where life came to Earth.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the joke in science is bacteria or archaea.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think we now believe that mitochondria of a human cell is a vestige of bacteria. And I think there's, I think I absolutely prescribe to that notion, that kind of one day bacteria ate an archaea.
Yeah.
And it all kind of came from there. Where the original bacteria came from, I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we are causing other forms of panspermia, possibly because we're sending space probes and we've probably not cleaned them super thoroughly, even though we try our best.
They are also, NASA's also consciously bringing bacteria to space for a number of reasons. One is that astronauts sustain all kinds of GI issues when they're in space. So starting to understand...
Because of the solar radiation is like more powerful and stuff
I think it's probably more due to motility. I mean, I'm sure there's a number of confounding factors, but probably a little bit of lack of motility because of gravity.
Interesting.
Which is just makes it, you know, digestion probably more challenging. The other aspect is bringing microbes to space because, of course, at a certain point, if people are really going to sustain space travel, exploration, and living, you're going to have to figure out how to grow food. And of course, fermentation is an excellent way to sustain food source.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, and then I think, the last way that microbes are kind of consciously making their way into space or purposely is to understand how they're going to behave in some of these environments. And so NASA's working, our chief scientist actually is working with NASA on a few of those initiatives already.
When I was looking at your background, is it correct, in another life you were a film producer?
Yes. Actually, it's funny. On my way here, I was on a film call because there's a number of documentaries that I was laughing, talking about film negotiation terms again because we are involved in a number of documentaries that will be coming out in the coming years.
How does that influence anything about Seed? Is there something about storytelling that you learned and that you're bringing
It influences Seed? Influences everything.
By the way, Paris Je T'aime, I grew up in Paris and it's a great movie. I love it. Yes. It's one that you worked on.
Yes, I did. Oh, that was a big chunk of my life.
Yeah.
That movie was very challenging to make, but one I'm very proud of. I think a lot of the films I was involved in always kind of typically broke some sort of structure.
Because what would you call that? It's a movie that has like... seven different directors or something like
20.
That.
I think the final cut had 19 arrondissements.
Oh my gosh.
In it, but every arrondissement of Paris had a different director.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, it's so great.
It was crazy. Yeah,
I need to rewatch it. I haven't seen it
since
it first came out.
You know, the Coen brothers one was, we shot in a metro station with Steve Buscemi, and it was, yeah, I mean, there were some incredible scenes. And it was a really interesting exercise also in perspective. So every arrondissement was told through someone else's perspective. We do that a lot with Seed. I think, of course, using different mediums, you know, I love Marshall McLuhan, and the medium I really believe is the message. And unfortunately, science has really not understood that well. And so I think we are always thinking about art and design, different aspects, packaging, of course, in how we show up in somebody's life to be able to communicate something scientific and in a way that could be really empowering. And so I also think that three-act structures are really what inform most of our marketing. We think a lot in terms of user experience and user design in 3Acts.
Well, give an example of that.
I mean, you know, humans want a beginning, a middle, and an end. And then if they really like it, they want a sequel. And then if they really like it, and if you think in like subscription commerce, it's like every month is a movie or an opportunity to tell a story. And so, you know, we think, or at least I think whenever we're designing like email flows and, you know, we're thinking about customer service flows, we're working on a number of things now that will touch kind of a much broader base of consumers. You know, I think we, and then also when we do, like when we think about a lot of our Instagram campaigns, I think a lot of them follow this kind of flow of like an introduction, some sort of like climax to in the second act, and then some sort of conclusion and takeaway, and often a like a dangling of
cliffhanger.
Like a, yeah, exactly. And so yeah, we think I always think in 3-act structures. I think
that's
even in terms of UI UX, in terms of, you know, how you bring somebody into a story. I think it absolutely informs everything I do in marketing. I think marketing is just, you know, kind of this weird intersection of storytelling and design.
So we're in the beginning, the introduction of Seed. What is the climax? What is the where would you like it to be in 40
years
or 50
years? I couldn't sell you a
ticket
if I told you that.
Well, when you dream about a world in which the philosophies that you have are more widely adopted, like what does that world look like? How is it different than today?
I'd say we make decisions about our bodies not driven by fear.
Hmm.
That everybody, kind of almost like what TED Talk did, you know, we always say we just want to be dinner party social capital. Okay. We just want to be the like, did you know? You know, and I think a lot of people who read our Instagram, for example, are always like, oh, I was the smartest one at the dinner party. I had all these cool facts to say. And I think that kind of empowerment, I think, you know, A, from a product perspective, I think we'd like to be known as the global standard in bacteria and microbiome related products. And so, you know, if you've bought ours, you've bought whatever is the reflection of the best science, the best manufacturing, the best testing.
But what does that do for the world? How does that change?
Depends which product, obviously. But I think overall, I think we believe that microbes are going to make a huge impact on human and planetary health. So whether it's our probiotic for honeybees, or it's
For
honeybees, yes.
Wait, explain that. You're making a probiotic for the bees?
So Seed Labs is our R&D arm that does all of our environmental and ecological research. And so our first project was on honeybees.
Yeah.
So we have a biopatty and a spray that we actually open source the IP for to farmers, and testing started in Canada. It's expanding to California now.
So you're selling this to honey?
We don't sell right now. We don't sell it. We're, okay. Anyone who wants to access it can just make it themselves. You don't actually need to.
Interesting.
You don't need to be selling. I mean, we can provide
the strains.
It's like
open source, or like can someone grow it themselves, or how does that even work?
You make it. We will be providing the strains, but if it's the patty itself, it's a very simple, it's like making a pancake.
Okay.
But the strains are what we would provide.
Wow. It's funny because, and this reminds me when I was thinking about, okay, you're selling this pill basically, is it for the human or is it for, like, who are you selling it to? Are you selling it to this community of bacteria that lives on you?
Yeah, who's the end user?
Bacteria
isn't just for your bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So probiotics actually have all kinds of host microbe interactions. So it's like human cells and microbes, as well as microbe-microbe interactions. So it's kind of for both.
Yeah, I just find
it... So it's a group subscription.
Well, it's funny because we've had this conversation on the show before. Like, we've had Ollie, which is a dog food subscription. Like, the consumer is the dog, but the person who's buying it is the human. Or we had a few different subscriptions and websites that are focused on kids' clothing, and they have to appeal to the parents. So it's just a weird idea of, like, okay, you're buying this product for a community of like single-celled organisms that is living in and on you. How do you convince the like one that has a credit card
that's right.
It's a good idea to do this?
Yeah, it's a really good point. In our case, it's hard to make the analogy just because a lot of it is for your human parts.
Yeah.
And actually that is another myth about probiotics, which is, that this idea that you kind of putting the good stuff in and then letting it grow and somehow like you just kind of take it for a period of time and then almost like an antibiotic and then you don't need to. Probiotics are actually transient microbes, which means they do their work on the road. So the benefits come from continuous consumption, not from just like taking it for like a short stretch like you would an antibiotic.
I want to talk about sustainability as we wrap up, like, yes. I don't know, yeah.
Let's end on a really short, non-den subject.
But there was a thing we were talking about before we started recording. I tweeted about this. I'm going to try again to put this term out there and see if it sticks. That we are in an era, like a geological time that I'm coining the plastiferous time. Mm-hmm. It's like a subset of the Anthropocene.
Mm-hmm. It's the Plasticine.
Well, no, it's the one before the Plasticine, because there's a time period called the Carboniferous, which is when basically trees evolved and started reproducing like crazy. There were trees everywhere, and they were uncontrollably growing, and they were falling and piling up all over the place until bacteria evolved to dissolve it, to ingest lignin and be able to turn that into like mulch, which can then be eaten by other organisms. And that process from the evolution of trees to the evolution of bacteria that could eat that material took like 100 million years or something like that. So we're in a phase right now of the Earth where we are creating a new substance that didn't really exist in plentiful amounts, which is plastic. And we're putting it all over the place, like these dead trees. And there are already...
The difference being that those trees propagated themselves, and that was due to the way carbon is structured, but yes.
Well, there's that's a whole other thing I can go into, but...
You should read our Instagram post from this morning about carbon.
Okay. Well, in any case, my general point is that there are already scientists studying how we could use bacteria for dissolving plastic material. And actually, like, I mean, digesting it really and turning it into something that can be used by other organisms. That has all kinds of dangerous implications for the world, because the reason plastic is used so much is because it doesn't degrade.
Right. Yes.
Like, that's a property that we look for. But I know that it's something that you mentioned on the bio on the Seed website. So I'm just curious about, like, I don't know. Where does that take you?
I'm not an expert on this, but I can tell you that the two distinct ways that we have experienced, that we are looking at and certainly are aware of in terms of how microbes are going to impact plastic, there's the using of bacteria to degrade microbes at scale. So putting them into landfills, for example, being able to figure out how you could take care of some of these like plastic islands by basically like putting microbes all over them and letting them eat them. And then of course, I know there are people working on how you could put microbes into bodies of water and also could metabolize and then of course take out a lot of the microplastic.
Right.
There are materials that are now being embedded. There's a company in the UK that is very far along in understanding, which I agree with you, it's kind of ironic that it's a application to plastic, single-use plastic bottles that actually, after their use, basically starts to activate a degradation period. And so they're kind of like coming with, almost like the bottle comes with its own like self-destruction mechanism.
Right.
That's bacteria.
Yeah.
So the first is, as I said, like applying microbes to like large areas of plastic where you could degrade them, which they have not, to my knowledge, we've looked at a number of solutions. It's very hard to do at scale, but they've done it in smaller testing. The second is, of course, putting it inside plastics so that you shorten the lifespan of that plastic after its primary use. And then the third is, which I think is most interesting to us and what is more interesting to us at Seed Labs, is the future of bioplastics, which is what would it mean if you could give bacteria something to metabolize and then create a substance, like bacteria can create like some sort of polymer that you could 3D print into a plastic. So it was coming, let's say from like corn waste or agricultural waste, for example. So you would feed them something that already needs to be, you know, not plastic, but mm-hmm. something of, you know, natural substance that they can metabolize and then create some sort of polymer from that would then be able to be 3D printed or molded into a plastic that had all the properties of plastic, but actually came from like corn, for example. And that area of research is probably more interesting to us.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting to talk about this because on your website, you have a page about sustainability that focuses a lot on packaging.
Yes.
For transparency, we make some of those things, but there's this bigger picture of how does our understanding of microbes potentially offer a solution to certain problems mm-hmm. that we're dealing with. And it's like a very fascinating area. Are there other things aside from digesting plastics that you think of as like these big problems that could be solved through microbes?
Oh, I mean,
sustainability.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, the most notable one will be the soil. I think. I think there will be the
reinvigorate soil.
Yeah. So the soil microbiome is really important because microbes are such a big part. I'll give you a good example of a project one of our scientists is working on that I think we find to be of most interest, which is, you know, in areas, for example, as natural resources deplete, how could microbes make soil nutrient dense? How could they maintain moisture? How could they make a root more drought resistant, for example, so that in a place where you are not getting as much water, you could still grow the same amount of food?
I see.
And microbes can play a big role in those things. So yeah, so I think in terms of thinking about the future of food supply, both in areas to date where there's issues, as well as in the future, as our natural resources deplete, there's no question that probiotics for the soil, microbes in the cleansing of water, for example, so microbes can metabolize lead and other metals to make clean drinking water.
Yeah.
100%. If we think bacteria, we may have tried to kill them for a long time, but I think that they, not only will they be here, they were here before us, they'll be here way after us. They will likely save us.
Wow. Sustainability. Let's come back to that general topic. Like, how did you approach it when you first kicked off kind of the packaging side? Because that's an area that you talk a lot about.
Yes.
And you mentioned to me before we started recording that you have some controversial views, which I don't know what they are. You just sort of said that in passing, but I'm curious to hear some of them.
I mean,
for the brave people who've like made it all the way to the end of the podcast.
You know, the most controversial perspective on sustainability is that you and I shut down our companies. We go put all these people that are incredibly smart and solution-oriented, i.e. startup entrepreneurs, who are capable of raising billions of dollars in a room, and we start one by one tackling the things that are fundamentally going to change our planet and make the human condition and the condition of our planet better. I mean, ultimately, it's stop making things.
Yeah.
Stop enabling people to make things. That's the ultimate sustainability, I don't think people like to talk about. But you know, we can talk. The only thing I get asked about sustainability is what's the most sustainable material to use for packaging. The first principles approach, which is another thing that we employ almost entirely at Seed, every time we think about something, which is you have to throw out the existing framework of what you're thinking within. Like I always say, look, the microbiome is to biology and our health what the DAT was to the music industry, right? Like you can either be what the music industry wasn't and allow things like Napster and other thing, or you can decide that you're going to be like, oh, new framework, new piece of major piece of data and major piece of information, how are we going to reframe this? And I think all I get asked about is, what do you think of this material? Or the carbon offsets, which we talked about for transportation. So how could you offset your transportation costs? Oh, what if we look to the natural environment for materials, because nature has been so smart and is the best designer. And so let's go commercialize nature. And so that, to me, it's like I was talking to you earlier about like the notion of tinkering versus 0 to 1. That, to me, it's all tinkering. It's important tinkering. So I don't want to not underline that because it's the kind of tinkering. I mean, we do it too, right? We went out and we're trying to figure out like, well, what is the most sustainable way to do what we do? And it's an important conversation, but like, I think entrepreneurs and the people who use the word sustainability aren't entirely honest if you're not talking about what ultimately, which as you pointed out before we started speaking, which is that you have to change consumption.
Yeah. That's number one.
And consumption sometimes doesn't change on the part of the consumer. Sometimes it changes because industry says this is how you are going to consume something. And I think that, there's a responsibility if you make things to at least not be blind about the fact that like you still make things.
Well, I mean, and this is such a insane area to try to talk to about, like as you know, we have a couple more minutes to go. But in the 60s, people were worried that the human population would grow exponentially to an unstoppable level. And we're actually now seeing that that's not the case, in that most likely in developed nations at some point, you know, within the next 20, 30 years, we're going to start seeing most developed countries decline in population. And that goes totally against the way that the capitalistic system that we live in is set up, because we're set up towards a world that is constantly growing the number of consumers, constantly increasing the amount of consumption per person, making you move through more stuff. And whether we like it or not, we're going to have to face that reality at some point, that the way the system is set up is not going to continue to work the same way unless we're like colonizing some other planet or something, and that's our method for growing the population or something like that.
Or what will happen, which has also happened in the history of humanity, which we're very close to, absolutely, based on the number of people who are no longer getting vaccinated, based on the overuse of antibiotics.
Right.
If we think that bacteria are also that 1% that aren't
disease,
great, if we think, or other communicable viruses, for example, or other pathogens, if we think that they're not going to get smart enough to do what they've always done,
we're in a world today with, you know, where everyone is closer to everyone else than ever before.
Yes, that's right. So one of our scientists likes to say, we've never brought our microbes all around the world the way we do now. So
yeah,
if you think about
crazy
microbes, you know, every time we travel, microbes that evolved in Africa over millennia in the gut of someone in, for example, in like Ghana, it now takes those microbes and goes to Japan and goes to the US and goes, or like, you know, in America, you know, myself, it's like I take my microbes around the world, and certainly they did not evolve to do that.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting way of thinking.
Yeah. I encourage people to go to seed.com and go through everything, but also your sustainability section, because I think you do a good job of explaining some of the choices that you've made.
And we also open source that. I mean, so you guys, I know you said full disclosure, but we do fully disclose.
Yeah.
Who makes all of our packaging? I think while we did scour the world and put a lot of hours and months of time into it, we do believe that that stuff should be open sourced, and we try and support all the vendors that we think are actually doing well, because to your point we were talking about earlier is that many of them are more expensive now because they're harder to scale some of these materials, but we believe that if more companies support them, they can get to scale, and therefore we can start hitting some of the cost of goods that some of the bigger companies require to be able to justify some of the more sustainable materials.
One of them that you're using is the insert, which is made of a mycelium, fungus. Like, explain a little bit for people who don't know that product. And I feel like it fits well with the identity of your company.
Yeah, there's two I'll mention. One is Ecovative, which is a company in upstate New York. And they figured out how to kind of compact agricultural waste. And then in trays, they use mycelium, which is just the root structure of a mushroom, to kind of grow these skins. So if you ever order, I highly encourage you to order our welcome kit, because you can kind of feel it. It almost feels like a cheese skin, but it's also kind of almost like a suede, like it's very soft.
Right.
And so that is what forms the skin over the waste, and they're able to mold that into anything you need to be like kind of a, almost like what you would typically see as like what is often made of, like a styrofoam, for example.
To actually contain, and because your product is shipped in glass, which is fragile.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
But also recyclable.
Yes, exactly. And we only ship you a glass jar once.
Yeah.
So you only get that once, and then in every month you get a refill. The thinking was you would just keep that one glass jar, and if you cancel, we made it pretty enough that it could just sit somewhere, put some pens in it,
put something else in.
And then we also ship it with a little glass vial A lot of people, when they travel, they use Ziploc bags or single-use plastic kind of baggies or other ways of kind of transporting their capsules or other supplements that they take. Or as my friends who go to Burning Man have reminded me, other substances. And so we provided a vial as well so that there's no more of that kind of like single-use plastic baggy stuff. And so, and then in our in our refills, we work with a company called Green Cell Foam out of Kentucky. And
second time in a row that they're mentioned on the podcast.
Oh, really? So we love them. Watch their videos. They're really funny. Yeah. They use like baseball bats and like hit bottles of wine packed in their corn foam. And they make a foam out of corn. The coolest thing about it is that it's it has both insulating properties. Of course, it has all the padding we need.
Right.
But then you literally can just, well, you can dissolve eat it, as my three-year-old thinks is so funny.
Yeah.
Or you just dissolve it in water.
I don't know if the nutritional content is particularly high.
It's corn. It's corn, probably some fiber in there.
Well, everyone should go check out your website, seed.com. Very yes. good domain name. What is it that you need help with right now? Do you
people?
Yeah, for people Humans. Who are listening, how could they help you?
First of all, all of our jobs are up on our website, and if anyone is inspired by what they heard today, or just a curious monkey, please check out what's open. But the biggest need, which might come from your audience, is someone to run social media for us.
Yeah.
We have a tall order.
What are you looking for?
An extraordinary synthesizer of science and pop culture, and someone who can think in memes and also wants to learn microbiology and or has a little bit of understanding. Someone who I think would be so inspired to wake up every day and not just tell the story of seed, but really try and invoke some of those ideas that I talked about earlier, which was, you know, how could you make science so awe-inspiring and fun and exciting and empowering that you can build a huge community of people that really care so much about the spreading of, you know, ideas that at least make you question everything else that you're told, which is really exciting.
Is this person going to be more of a creator or a like sharer or a wordsmith, or what are they?
They don't have to be like a designer. We have plenty of design resources and photography resources. It's much more somebody who can look at the course of a year and say, here are the stories that we need to be telling on these different channels. Here's the way we want to be telling them. Here are the formats and the franchises and the styles that we want to employ. This is what we would do on stories to bring our company to life. This is what we would do in the feed to be able to kind of tell. For example, we just kicked off a campaign last night called basically kind of exploring what we are made of. And so it would be like, for 1 week, we're just going to remind people like what they're actually made of. Someone who wants to bring our scientists to life and the incredible superorganisms that we always kind of come into contact with in the world who are doing such interesting work. The person who gets excited to think about how do we talk about our bee research on YouTube, on Reddit, on, you know, someone who could really just think like, you know, again, the medium is the message. And so what are the ways and the strategies and the formats that you employ to be able to kind of communicate both some of these big ideas, but also, you know, all the way down to, you know, for Valentine's Day, we made like funny screenshotable Valentine's Day cards that were, you know, science jokes. And so someone who can kind of have a really, a range of storytelling tools in their toolkit.
I saw that you mentioned curiosity as a big thing, and it's actually the number one, we put this on every job posting. Our list of things that we look for that we expect people who come to Lumi to have.
Yes.
And curiosity is the number one thing that we look for. I'm curious, how do you test for that when you're hiring?
A number of ways. We're very cognizant of the way people engage with us, even on an email, even in scheduling the time they're coming to the office. We can usually tell, honestly, within even just the way someone responds and reaches out to us in about 2 seconds, whether or not someone has that. It's a barometer. And I think also, like, even in a first meeting, the answer is, what did you read to get here?
Right.
Like, how could you show up at our office? Like, how could you read our website, read this description, and then come here and not be able to tell me what the microbiome is and not have, like, 100 questions?
Yeah.
And so typically the curiosity is, I would say, the number one barometer is language.
Yeah.
I should say our compass is often around language. Not because someone needs to be like always hyper intellectual and use big words, but actually there's a care in language. I mean, I can't tell you how many people tell us they're writers and they write us emails with spelling errors. So it's probably the first
It's a pet peeve of mine.
We put spelling errors into our writing our writing descriptions as a test. Yes.
Interesting.
And then the quality of questions is what we care about, because questions are the reflection of how you choose to synthesize information. And I think that is a fundamental idea and core tenet of who we are.
It says a lot about how your brain works, like what question you ask and if you have any questions. Sometimes, you know, I'll be interviewing someone and I try to open things up and ask them, hey, do you have any questions? And it's very like polarizing thing.
Yes.
Like some people have immediately a million questions and some people don't. And it tells you a lot about their, I don't know, the way that they think.
100%.
Yeah.
And to us, I think it's the questions, and then also it's what informed them.
Fascinating. Thank you so much. This was amazing. And everyone should go to seed.com. There's so many books and authors and different people mentioned. We'll try to put all of those things in the show notes at wellmade.show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Ooh, one last thing before we go. I'm talking to you at home. What's your favorite brand these days? Is there something that you think is really well made? Or maybe someone that you'd love for me to talk to? Send us a tweet. We are at Lumi, L-U-M-I, on Twitter. We're making this show for you, so tell us what you want to hear, and we'll make it happen. Thanks. See you next time.